Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's guest is something of a rare bird, but becoming less so all the time. Republican Bob Inglis, a former South Carolina congressman, lost his bid for re-election in 2010 for what many considered heresy, saying publicly that not only is climate change real, but that it's our duty to do something about it. Slate magazine says his about-face on climate change makes him, quote, America's best hope for near-term climate action. In 2012, Inglis launched the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, which promotes conservative and free enterprise solutions, not subsidies and government regulations, to address climate change. Bob Inglis, welcome to Take Note.
Great to be with you, Patty. Thank you.
You served two non-consecutive terms in Congress in what you have called the reddest district in the reddest state, and you also have very serious conservative credentials. You're staunchly anti-abortion. You've earned an A-plus from the NRA. You're an ardent champion of the free enterprise system. And up until 2008, you were in lockstep with your Republican colleagues in denying climate change. What made you do an about-face on that?
It was the most powerful force in the universe. It was love. It started it all because my son came to me when I was running again. I was in 6 years, then I was out 6 years, and I was running again in 2004. My son came to me. He was voting for the first time. He just turned 18, and he said, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. And so I knew, as my son was saying, that he loved me and he wanted me to be better than the first time around. Plus the fact that his four sisters, younger than he and his mother, all agreed, that makes a big difference. So that was the first step. Second step, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings in Antarctica. In science committee trips. And then third step, another science committee trip.
As a congressman, you went to Antarctica.
Yeah. And the third step was this science committee trip and an encounter with an Aussie climate scientist who's become dearest friend that showed me that it's a way of loving God and loving people to care for this creation and to care for the people who will come after us. And so that inspiration sent me back to Congress to introduce a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax that got me in a lot of trouble. But so it was really is the love and care of those people that made me change. And it is the most powerful force in the universe.
And we're going to talk about this carbon tax that you are proposing. But despite the fact that you were rejected by your constituents, you remain a proud conservative, and you actually say that it's bedrock conservatism to fix this problem.
Right. It is completely consistent with what we believe as conservatives. And in our presentations, we use the voice of Ronald Reagan. We use the voice of Milton Friedman to show that this is exactly what we believe. You know, if you and I were going into business, we'd want to have our accountant show us all the cost of option A and all the cost of option B. We'd want all the cost revealed to us so we could make a good choice. Well, that's what we in free enterprise do all the time. And in politics, my party has typically been the one that's understood that most clearly. But here, we've got blinders on as to the climate cost. And that's got to change. We need to take off those blinders for conservatives and realize that, oh, we got the answer. It's free enterprise. If you have an accountable free enterprise system, this works.
And what you're talking about is pricing carbon emissions. How do you price them? And how important is it that it's not only the United States pricing carbon, but the whole world pricing carbon emissions?
So, it's so essential that the whole world be in on this. So it starts with American leadership. And it would presumably start with what's called an upstream application of a carbon tax. That means at the mine and at the pipeline, you impose a tax on carbon dioxide. And if you think about it, it's a very small job for the IRS because there are under 2,000 companies that either mine coal or that drill for natural gas and petroleum or that put it in pipelines. So between the pipeline companies and the mine operators, it's under 2,000 taxpayers, a very small job. You apply the tax there. And then it hits all downstream. Now, here's the problem, of course, Patty. That means the price of everything goes up downstream, but not artificially. It goes up to the actual price, the full cost, the costs that aren't seen when we burn fossil fuels right now. If you attach those costs, then they're coming through the pipeline that way, and we all get to see them. We start innovating. It also has to be combined, though, if you're going to tax carbon dioxide in that way. It has to be combined with a tax cut somewhere else.
And where would that tax cut come?
Well, I think it could be,
applied.
It could be a corporate income tax, it could be an individual tax reduction, or it could be a payroll tax reduction. Any of those things would do, and it'd also be okay to dividend the money back to the taxpayers, just as long as it's what we call in government speak revenue neutral. That means that there'd be no growth of government, that if you have this new carbon tax, you've cut taxes somewhere else, or you've dividended the money back, so there's no growth of government. The second essential for us at republicen.org is that it be border adjustable, and that's government speak for we're going to apply it on imports, so they have to pay too.
So in other words, if China is selling a Barbie doll in the American market, there will be a carbon tax applied to it.
Correct, on entry into the United States. And of course, presumably they would object, and they'd take us to the World Trade Organization and say that's an impermissible tariff. We think we could win that case because of precedents in the chemical industry that allow a country to tax based on the content of the goo coming in. And so based on the Barbie doll's carbon content, because there is carbon in the making of that plastic from the petroleum, a lot of CO2 was emitted, right? And so you attach that price to that Barbie doll, and China challenges us. We win, we think, in the WTO. And then they are left with a choice. What shall we do? Shall we continue to pay a tax on entry into the United States of Barbie dolls? Or shall we impose the same price here in China and collect that tax ourselves? Well, I think it's pretty clear they can do the latter. They're going to impose a tax themselves. And then that Barbie doll would come in through, say, the Port of Philadelphia without any adjustment. And so it becomes in their interest to follow American leadership.
You say that what you're proposing is really not that different from what Al Gore has been proposing for three decades. How are you going to sell that to conservatives when he couldn't?
Well, it's because we've got to have tribal members speaking to their tribes in the native language. And so
conservatives speaking to conservatives.
Right. You know, when Vice President Gore speaks, he speaks progressive language, and he speaks it well to the audiences that love him.
And you always thought that human-induced climate change was, quote, hooey, until you went to Antarctica and saw the evidence for yourself.
Right, and really was transformed by the love of my son and the love of my Aussie climate scientist friend, you know, that made it so that this is really about, you know, serving God and serving people. And then it became important to me. But so Vice President Gore goes and speaks to progressives and does a great job there. He gets them all charged up. We have to do the same thing with conservatives in the language of conservatism. And at the end of the day, I think we can bring America together because it works for both conservatives and progressives to have this sort of accountability.
Well, the interesting thing is that as the executive director of Republic EN, capital EN, you meet one-on-one with Republican lawmakers who quietly believe in the science of climate change, but they aren't comfortable making that position public. And you are not in the business of naming or shaming them.
Right. Yeah, we don't out people before they're ready to come out to their family and friends and constituents, right? And we want to be their best friend. You know, right now, the action, say, on the right is typically groups that call up and say to you, Patty, get right or get gone in this next election. And it's a credible threat because they will primary you on the right and take you out. We're the opposite of all that. We say, Patty, we want to be your best friend. How can we help you? We know that you're hearing from your kids who are coming home from college, telling you what they're learning in college. And, you know, I really believe this conversation is happening at a lot of kitchen tables with Republican members of the House and Senate, is the kids were home for the summer, and they were saying, Mom, Dad, you know what you're saying on the floor of the House and the Senate? It's really behind the times. Do you realize you're spending all this money to send me to college?
And I don't believe what you're saying.
Yeah, and what you're saying on the House and Senate floor is just retro, Mom and Dad. And so why don't you get with it? And so we think that that's what's going to move things, is that it's just like with my son, helping me to see that, you know, really, listen, Dad, you can do better than you did before in your first time in Congress. The second go around, let's make it better.
Well, help progressives, you know, understand this. You've got conservatives who they believe the science when it comes to the safety of genetically modified organisms. And they believe the science when it comes to vaccines. But they don't believe the 97% of scientists who believe that there is human-induced climate change.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, isn't it? It all depends on where we hear that science from. We have trusted people who tell us things. You know, if we know somebody cares for us, they can tell us most anything, right? If we think they don't, we don't really want to hear from them. So, for example, as I said earlier, one of the steps in my metamorphosis was this Aussie climate scientist with the Penn State connection. If he told me most anything, I'd be willing to listen to it and probably heed it, right? But compare that to a time I was at a conference and a guy turns to me and says, did you buy carbon offsets for your travel here? And I said, because I just read something in the Wall Street Journal about it, I said, no, that's a scam, isn't it? And he says, he turns to the guy next to him and says, that's what they all say when they don't want to be responsible. Now, if that guy told me that today is the day that it is on the calendar, I'd look at the calendar just to make sure. Because, I mean, he'd already told me he didn't like me and that he was holier than me and that he was righteous and I was unrighteous. Well, I don't want to hear anything from him now. And so it's very important that we approach people with some humility and giving them the grace of being able to turn around and to face the evidence and not make them feel like they're dumb or slow or guilty or sinners and we're righteous. I mean, how attractive is that?
You say all of that is toxic to the process and words matter.
Yeah, words matter and heart attitude matters. We got to show people that, listen, we're all in this together and we can come together on this and the world is counting on us.
So what difference would it make if instead of asking, and you have been asked this by conservative radio talk show hosts and gotten booed for answering yes, but what if instead of do you believe in human-induced climate change or is it a fact, what if the question were instead how can we address climate change?
Oh, you're really onto something there, Patty, because here's what we think. We've tried to inject this in debates. We'd love it if it were in the presidential debates, is don't ask the question, do you believe? Do you believe in climate change? Well, now the problem with that is if you answer in the affirmative and you're a conservative, you've just cut yourself off from the audience watching.
They've turned their heads off.
Right. But if the question is asked this way, can free enterprise solve climate change? Well, I defy any conservative to answer that in the negative. Because, you know, free enterprise can solve problems you don't even have as far as we're concerned. In other words, we conservatives believe in the power of free enterprise. And so ask the question, can free enterprise solve climate change? Well, yes, of course it can. It can if you fix the economics and put all the cost in on all the fuels, eliminate all the subsidies, watch the free enterprise system sort this out. So the question is essential. If you make it a question of belief and it sounds like a religion or something, then of course they're going to shy away from that. But if you ask, can free enterprise solve climate change? Wow, that's a very different discussion.
So explain, if you would, how this tax you're talking about is a revenue neutral tax, different from other carbon taxes and taxes that, for example, the Koch brothers have been vigorously advertising against.
Yeah. So the key thing is that we cut taxes somewhere else in equal amount, dollar for dollar, no growth of government. And so we're open, as I say, to corporate income tax reduction, individual income tax reduction, payroll tax reduction, or a dividend. But whatever it is, it needs to be 100% revenue neutral so that people have money in their pocket to afford the innovation that's going to be coming down the pike. And we are going to get that innovation. Once we fix the economics, they're going to be new products. They're going to be new opportunities. The battery is going to improve dramatically because the economics are going to drive it. It's just like cell phones. Very expensive. My first cell phone, I remember, it was actually a bag phone. It had a cord on it. You remember those?
Yes, I do.
And it was about $1 a minute to talk on the phone to a relatively few places you could talk with limited coverage. Now it's unlimited minutes on those things, and a lot of us have them in our pockets. Same thing's going to happen with distributed energy systems around the world.
I want to follow up on that in just a moment, but if you are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Republican Bob Inglis, a former South Carolina congressman who lost his 2010 bid for re-election after telling a radio host he believed humans were contributing to climate change. In 2015, he was awarded the John F. Kennedy Foundation's Profile in Courage Award, bestowed each year since 1989 to a public servant who takes a principled but unpopular position. Speaking of innovation, you say that for this to work, we have to end all subsidies for all fuels. And I think a lot of people are going to say, Well, that's fine if you're in the fossil fuel industry, because you've had decades of subsidies for R&D, and for these new players, these new green alternative fuels, they're at a real disadvantage. 70% of all federal energy subsidies continue to go to oil and natural gas and coal.
This is true. A lot of subsidies have gone and still go to petroleum and natural gas. And yeah, we want to eliminate all those. Now, whether that means that we should continue with propping up the alternatives, we think not. We think what we should do is simply level the playing field. That means no more Solyndras. That was a direct subsidy of a company. And yeah, we think we should eliminate electric car credits. We think we should eliminate production tax credit for wind, for the solar credits. We also think we should eliminate undermarket leases on public land for the extraction of minerals and accelerated depreciation for oil and gas. All those things should go away. And then end the biggest subsidy of them all, which is being able to dump into the trash dump of the sky without paying a tipping fee for the damages you're causing there, for the space you're taking up in that dump.
But you also want to roll back EPA regulations.
Well, yeah.
Make the EPA smaller.
Yeah, there would be the advantage of being able to eliminate some EPA regulations that are now trying to get at greenhouse gases, because if you put a price on carbon dioxide, we're gonna observe what economists call the substitution effect. People are going to substitute away from fossil fuels and into alternatives. And as they do, emissions are going to go down. So that being the case, we're going to accomplish the objective a different way than through these regulations. And so, yeah, you can actually repeal some Clean Air Act regulations that become redundant. That doesn't mean that we want to eliminate the whole EPA or all of the Clean Air Act. We clearly don't want to do that. But what we do want to do is, where you have redundancies, for goodness sake, strengthen the government if you have any chance to.
If you were able to go back and do it all over again, what did you do wrong in 2010 that cost you an election?
I didn't understand the pressure and the pain that my constituents were under. It was a scary time. You know, the Great Recession was upon us. It really looked like the wheels were coming off of the financial system. And people were very concerned. And I think I should have been more sensitive to that, and I was a little bit of a bull in the china shop, saying, "Oh no, we can get this done. Come on, let's get going." And I was maybe impatient and a little bit condescending, I think, to the people that I represented. I needed to be more understanding and a little bit more affirming of their concerns, but helping them to see that there's a bright future. I will tell you though, I don't regret trying to keep an optimistic affect. We had a slogan. Our slogan in 2010, to show you how out of touch I was, it was "America's sun is still rising." I knew then it was not consistent with the times. That what we needed to be saying was, "Ain't it so bad?" But I don't think that leaders are leading when they just accommodate people in their fears and use those fears. You're leading when you say, "I understand the fears," and that's what I should have done better. I should have been better at saying, "I understand the fear, but here's a way out, and here's how we can do it." And then patiently presented that rather than present it with a little bit of condescension that I think I had.
You know, on one hand, you say the problem with the progressives is that they're selling this with doom and gloom, and that you're going to have to do more with less. And you say the opposite. You say with a free enterprise system solution, we will have more energy, more mobility, and more freedom. Explain how.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, for example, the cell phone example, if you look back at what we were paying, I remember when I was in college, my parents were thankfully very supportive of me talking to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, long distance. It was enormously expensive for me to dial from Bluffton, South Carolina to Statesville, North Carolina, spending about $100 a month of my parents' money on those phone calls. But now, you can dial long distance on your cell phone. It doesn't cost you anything. I mean, so the innovation that's come has come from free enterprise. Now, mind you, it started with the government. DARPA created the internet and the PC. Judge Green broke up AT&T. There were some government actions there that led to a very competitive situation that unleashed the power of free enterprise in telecommunications. We're waiting for that to happen to energy. When it happens, prices are going to come down, new products are going to come to market. It's very exciting.
Well, explain to me what role the government will have in addressing climate change, or should have, in your opinion.
I think it should be the honest cop on the beat that puts all the cost in on all the fuels and eliminates all the subsidies and says, now, honest cop, you all compete. And nobody gets subsidies. And nobody gets away with being unaccountable for those emissions.
Speaking of honesty and fear, Donald Trump is saying that climate change is a hoax. President Obama is saying he's alone in the world in thinking that, which may be overstating it. But that brings me to Mark Twain's famous quote. He famously said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. And this election year, there have been plenty of lies all around. What to you, what in your mind, is the most egregious lie candidates are telling us this election season?
I think it's that America can't do it. You know, I think that is, it's not necessarily a lie. It's accommodating us at our lowest and least, as John Ashcroft said when he was running for president. I think it's his best line. We should not accommodate America at her lowest and least. We should challenge her to be her greatest and best. And so I'm not sure it's a lie, as I say. It's just this sort of thing that, well, okay, we're tired and we got to sit down. You know, I get inspiration from JFK's speech at Rice University, 17 minutes of pure American exceptionalism. He acknowledges, better than I did, as I was just saying, I should have been able to say these kind of words, as he said in that speech. He said something to the effect that, I understand that there's some people who would sit here and rest for a while. But he goes on to say, America was not built by people who waited and rested. To sort of accommodate America at our lowest and least, when we're in down and out position after the Great Recession and thinking that we're down on our luck and we're done for and all that stuff, and just sort of repeat that to the American people, is such a disservice. What we should be saying is, no, we are the America, the blessed, which is blessed with so many things. And at what time period in human history would you rather be alive than right now? This is the best time in human history to be alive. So greet it with enthusiasm and excitement, not with this sort of given up kind of atmosphere.
And that's your current slogan, is energy optimist, climate realist. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, energy optimists, that's big for us, is we want to be, we're about more energy, more mobility, more freedom, because that's what we conservatives want to see in energy. And I realize that some on the left, particularly the environmental left, they don't maybe mean to, but what they're perceived by the right is saying is that humans are some sort of invasive species here, you know, that we're not meant to be here or something. It's very off-putting. And they might not mean to say that, but that's how they're perceived on the right. And so we come along and we say, no, more energy, more mobility, more freedom. But we also say climate realism, which is that, of course, there's a problem here. It's clear from the data. The science is really pretty clear.
You talk about this respect for the facts, but then on the other hand, you say it's important that you shape your message in a way that doesn't offend anyone, when sometimes the facts can be pretty offensive. This is what's happening, and it's serious, and it can be doom and gloom.
Well, I'll give you an example. If I go in to see my dermatologist, and he says, oh my gosh, Bob, I've never seen one that big. You know, now he's got a head injury because I've passed out, you know. And so rather than just a basal cell carcinoma that maybe he needs to numb up, take a biopsy of, and then have me back in 2 weeks to remove it, right? But if he calmly says to me, Bob, I think this is a basal cell. Let's just take a little biopsy here and you'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll get the thing off. Then we've got calm, right? Some people run around looking like they got their hair on fire about climate change. We don't do that because we think it's very important to show that there's risk and there's a way to deal with the risk.
Well, that makes me think of Senator John McCain in 2008 when he was running for president. He acknowledged that climate change was real because he linked it to national security. But then he also said, and I quote, I just leave the issue alone because I don't see a way through it. Is that attitude part of our inability to get things moving here?
It might have been, you know, that's the way it might have been at some point in the past. But I think going forward, what we're going to find more and more is that millennials especially hold action on climate as a value. It is not a political position. And so if you want to be a representative of a party of the future or a movement of the future, you're going to have an answer to climate change.
Well, speaking of young people, the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs was under severe fire after three professors warned their class that there would be no debate on whether or not humans caused climate change. This was a class that was team taught. And they told the students, if you have a problem with that, drop the class and take a different one. And so that makes me wonder, number one, what's your reaction to the fallout that this university has felt by saying, we're not debating whether this is happening or not, it is. And what role should universities play in all of this?
Well, I have mixed feelings because on the one hand, I understand what the professors were saying. Listen, if you want to debate climate science, that's not for this course. This course is going to be about adaptation or mitigation, whatever it's about. On the other hand, one of my key folks on my team actually took a climate science class at Georgetown University in order to sort of heckle the professor, and in the process became aware of the reality of the science, and now he's one of my key people. So I have mixed feelings about whether you should engage in that debate or say, listen, we're not debating in this particular class. But I think it is important for universities to be open to debate. It's hard to figure out how to do that debate when really it's sort of like this. You need to have on stage 97 climate scientists who present the scientific position on climate change, and you need to have three people who are disputing that scientific position. That'd be the accurate presentation of the debate.
So tangibly people would see this.
Right, but if you have two up there, one that's saying this is a scientific position, one that's saying it's not real, it's misleading because you really should have 97 chairs up there and three chairs.
Well, let me ask you this final question, because we are less than 2 months out from this presidential election. And in this whole long process, precious little time has been spent talking about climate change. How do we make this the top rather than the bottom of our priority list for voters, for candidates, and others?
That's the key, Patty, isn't it? It's increasing what political scientists call, or pollsters call, the salience of the issue, right? I mean, it's low salience and high importance, and that's a really difficult place to be, right? It's very important to us for the future, but it's really way down on everybody's list. And so, you know, the economy, terrorism, those kind of things are at the top of the list. What we have to do is I think convince ourselves that we can do more than one thing at a time. You know, that we can deal with this. This is, and it will help us in a lot of other ways. So, for example, where do terrorists get all the money? Well, by selling oil. Okay, then maybe we can change that a little bit, change the economics there on them. And so somehow we have to convince people that this is the right time to be acting. We need to approach it with enough urgency to get people to act, but not over urgency such that they shut down. Because if you tell me we're all going to die, well, then denial is a pretty good coping mechanism. But if you tell me, listen, we got a problem, the building is on fire, there are exits, follow me to the exit, I know where it is, then we can get out of the building alive.
And that sounds like a perfect ending to our conversation. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to be with you, Patty. Thank you.
That was Republican Bob Inglis, a former South Carolina congressman who committed political suicide by publicly saying that climate change is not only real, but that we need to do something about it. Today, he's executive director of Republican, spelled with a capital E, small n, and he's working full-time on free enterprise solutions to climate change. To learn more about Inglis and his free enterprise initiative, or to hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.